My name is Allison Penner. I'm at Columbia University in New York, New York, with Ron Greeley. The date is June 15th, 2012, and we are doing an interview on the practices of oral history and Ron's experience with that. So I guess just to get started here, what attracted you to oral history? How did you become an oral historian?
It's kind of a mundane answer. I was looking for a job. I had finished my residency at Rutgers University for the PhD, and I had taken a one-year teaching assignment at Lafayette College in East Pennsylvania. At that time, I was married. I had four children. My daughter, who was the fourth, was born in Easton that January. I was looking for a job, and at that point in time, the job market was very expensive. It was quite easy to get jobs, and I had turned down two jobs. One, simply because the place was too ugly for us to live. I tell that to students now, they can't believe the arrogance of it. I mean, incredible. But it was July, and I had not secured a job. I had been considered for a couple, but I had not gotten one. And the former head of the history department at Rutgers, Henry Winkler, had gone to Washington to become the editor of the American Historical Review. And he called one evening and asked me, he knew I was looking for a job. He said, there's a job opening at the Kennedy Library in Washington, D.C., at the National Archives doing oral history. And I said to him, what's oral history? And he said, don't worry, you'll learn. So I was looking for a job. And I applied for the job and went down for an interview. And Charles Morrissey, who was one of the founders of oral history in the United States, one of the forefathers, I don't know who the other three were, but one of the forefathers of oral history. And Charlie was had just come out as the head of the oral history program for the Kennedy Library. And he hired me, and I began my career at the Kennedy Library as an interviewer and archivist. It was then located at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. So that's my first experience in oral history, working for the Kennedy Library.
Can you tell me about your very first interview that you ever conducted?
Yes, I can. Charlie was widely read. There wasn't that much of a bibliography in oral history, but he had read it, and he was very interested in other fieldwork sciences such as folklore and linguistics and anthropology, etc. And there was a wide literature on interviewing practices, etc. So working with Charlie was really a training ground for interviewing, and as for the actual practice, we went out together. While he was doing interviews, I would sit in and watch him do the interviews. And gradually, I guess the first interview I ever participated in was an interview he had done with a congressman by the name of Torbert McDonald, who was a close friend of Kennedy's. But my first interview was with a woman by the name of Marjorie McKenzie Lawson. And she and her husband, Belford Lawson, were John Kennedy's main entree into the African-American community. And they had been longtime operatives within the Democratic Party, and they were hooked into all of the preachers and the black fraternities and sororities, the black bourgeoisie, which had been mobilized over many years within the Democratic Party from the Depression on. And they were key figures in all of that until a man who later became senator from Pennsylvania, whose name escapes me right now, but it might come to me, who had been in India with Chester Bowles and been very affected by Gandhi, and he had made contact with Martin Luther King. And this person through Chester Bowles, who was a Kennedy person, told Kennedy that he had to make contact with Martin Luther King. So sometime before the 1960 election, Kennedy moved gradually to make contact with a different kind of African-American leadership, leaving Belford and Marjorie Lawson kind of on the sidelines. And they bitterly resented it, bitterly resented it. And she was my first interview. And I had really looked at very carefully at all of the civil rights stuff and all of the interior of the civil rights movement. And mostly she wanted to talk about being a woman with all those Irish Catholic men and their attitudes towards women. And it quite surprised me. I was not prepared for that. You know, it was interesting first lesson. Be prepared for whatever surprises come along. I had totally misread her career with the Kennedys. She blamed some of the loss of contact within the Kennedy administration on Robert Kennedy and the O'Donnell and all the Irish mafia, because they couldn't stand working with an aggressive woman. And this was long before, Betty Friedan had been published, but it was long before people talked in that way. But that was my first interview, and it was a marvelous interview. She was very, very critical of Robert Kennedy at that time, and this is 1965. Robert Kennedy, of course, later became very, very close to the African-American community, and she closed the interview. The interview remained closed for many years.
Is it open now?
I don't know. I don't know. The latest biography of Kennedy didn't seem to mention it, so I don't know.
That's fascinating.
That's my first experience, my first interview.
It's interesting because so many people, their first interviews are for like school projects or smaller things. That's, quite a prestigious interview to begin with. What would you say has been your worst interview?
Oh, the worst interview I ever had, Mary Marshall mentions it all the time, is with Vella Abzug. And it was, it was a terrible experience. Bella Abzug was a leading American feminist, and she was a congresswoman from New York City, and she had been involved in Women's Strike for Peace. She was an activist, long-time activist. Very, very dynamic person. And a very close friend of Shirley MacLaine's. And I was then head of the office here at Columbia, and I got a call from Shirley MacLaine. And Shirley MacLaine had been visiting Bella, and she was moving. Bella was moving. And there were all these boxes outside her door waiting to be picked up by the garbage man. And they were all her records. And Shirley MacLaine prevented them from being destroyed. And she was shocked by all this. And she called and she said, Bella has to have be interviewed. And I said, wonderful. Shirley MacLaine was going to put up the money. The way in which Columbia operated then, and still to a large extent does, is that you have to fund. We have to fund all of our interviews. And so I contacted Abzug, and she refused to be interviewed. No interest in it whatsoever. No. She was busy with day-to-day life, and to look, reflect on the past was nothing that she would ever be interested in doing. And so a number of years passed, and Mary Marshall came on on board, and things changed, and Bella Abzug moved on to doing different kinds of things. And she was very, very friendly with a number of women historians with whom I was very friendly. And so they wanted me to interview Bella Abzug, and so I agreed to do that. And then I contacted Shirley MacLaine. Unfortunately, I had never kept any correspondence, or I had never written her after the telephone conversation. She had completely forgotten about it. And I got a call from Bella Abzug just screaming at me for asking her friend for money for this interview. Who the fuck do you think you are? It was really a terrible, terrible experience. But anyway, after an hour or so, and then a meeting afterwards with a very close friend of hers, Amy Swerdlow, who's a close friend of mine. Amy had been with her for Women's Strike for Peace many, many years. She agreed to be interviewed, and it was a terrible interview, just terrible. I was interested in the way she became a feminist. You know, she had always been a feminist. It was never a question for her. And she was thinking about how she would use this to write her biography. And if she couldn't find in the session what she could write the next week, she was totally uninterested. And after one or two sessions, I had to give... Amy was telling me I should ask her about this, ask her about that. Every time I did, it was off kilter. And eventually, Mary Marshall took it over and did three or four interviews, and then she became ill and died. And so we never got a full interview, but we got a richer interview with Mary Marshall. But that was my worst interview.
And you were so tenacious in actually getting it, too, after kind of being rebuffed so many times.
Well, you know, as I think about it over the years, what I should have done is when she first started screaming at me, I should have just hung up. I should have. So the hell with it. And then allow my friends to renegotiate that and have a different interviewer and not even getting involved. I should have hung up.
Do you think that there's certain situations where even if you're the only person available, you just shouldn't do the interview anyways?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
There's no chemistry. In fact, we say this to people often when we interview them here at Columbia. We did. But if they're unhappy with the interviewer, let us know. We'll get another interview. Sometimes there just is no chemistry. Some people cannot interview other people. Some people cannot be interviewed by other people. They deeply resent the style, the manner, whatever it might be, subjective or objective.
What do you like about doing oral history interviews, and what do you not like?
It's an interesting question. I was asked to, as you know, do these things for the Croatian students. And when they asked me about the Kennedy Project, I said, I discovered I'd like to interview, but I never thought about why. And so I've been thinking about why since then. I'm good at it. I really am good at it. And one enjoys what one is good at. I grew up in a small New England town where there was a public green, where all these old men used to gather and gossip all the time. And I grew up in a family of gossips. And I always liked gossip. I liked listening to gossip, et cetera. And, you know, a natural snoop, I guess. And theoretically, you know, I'm always interested in the story behind the story. You know, I was waiting for structuralism to happen to discover that it's really important to understand the deep structure of things. I can elaborate this into a theoretical way that one listens for what is told and untold. You know, when I read Louis Althusser, I've talked about how important Althusser was to me, but it wasn't the political side of Althusser that was important. It was the discussion of symptomatic reading. What is symptomatic reading? How do we read symptomatically? How do we take what is being said to us as a symptom of something larger, a larger condition, a more complex phenomena, if you will? And I've always liked that about interviewing, that people tell you things and there are undertones and overtones. And words can never quite capture the total essence of an experience. The only way of getting that is more words. And there's a French post-structuralist, Luis Irigaray, or I don't know, Irigaray. Who talks about this kind of ineffable reality that you have to use words, but words cover so many complexities of an experience. And the only way of getting at it is more words. And that's intriguing to me. Intriguing. What don't I like about it? I don't like it sometimes when... On the Kennedy Project, this was a problem, but also it's happened to me a number of times interviewing, quote-unquote, members of the elite, and we can talk about that in a moment. Sometimes you're considered as hired help. This is the hired help. When I worked on the Kennedy Project, we had a wonderful team, and there was a young kid. We were all young at the time. And he was Irish Catholic. He was so fascinated by the Kennedys. And he believed that by interviewing on the Kennedy Project, he became part of the Kennedy Circle. I tried to tell him, Joe, we're only hired help. You are not part of the Kennedy circle. It's on my left, on the left hand, a lot of friends of mine believe that by interviewing working class people, they come become members of the working class. And in my particular group of friends, we call that false proletarianization. And the same thing happens on elite interviews. People interview people who are wealthy and this, that, and the other, and they believe that they're part of that crowd. Well, you're not. You're not. And it takes a great deal of self-awareness, I think, to do interviews. You have to be. You have to know who you are. And I resent being, in that sense, treated as the hired help, or you know, people who don't take the history seriously. And, mm-hmm.
Yeah. You had said that in an interview, you need to know who you are. Have you found that as you do interviews, who you are changes by listening to the stories?
Well, first of all, it changes over time. Yeah. I am no longer a young PhD feeling my oats in the field. You know, I am now retired, senior. So it has changed. But my style of interviewing has always been more or less professional, in the sense that I'm interested in the history, and I consider myself a historian. And that is who I am, is a historian. And I'm concerned about how we turn this document into a history. What have you learned for the practice of history? Moving beyond feeling good, moving beyond the ambience of the interview where you like each other, where you get along, where you're concerned about that, to what is it as history? And that demands a certain kind of distance. There is a distance in the interview. And I would go more toward a more distant approach. Other people get much closer. They do the same things. Other people a little further. Some people who are journalists are trained to do interviews in a certain kind of way that is much more staccato in a sense of interrupting, moving it forward on their terms rather than on the terms of the person you're talking to. And it has to be judged, my feeling is it has to be judged by what's produced at the end. Do they get what is needed for the particular purpose of the project? It's just a matter of style, knowing what is your style, what are you comfortable with? And you establish that in your presence almost immediately. Now, some of my feminist friends have critiqued that as a masculine style. And that may be true, but it is a style I'm comfortable with, and it's my style.
Yeah, you mentioned this idea of doing interviews to feel good is kind of this new understanding of oral history that's developed, probably exemplified best by the StoryCorps project. Can you speak to your understanding of the differences between oral history and the kind of project that would be exemplified by that type of StoryCorps?
I have a long critique of StoryCorps, probably too long to get into right now. But I'm interested in conversation. And I had a discussion with a young man who was a student of Habermas. And we got talking about Habermas's distinction between conversation and discourse. You know, there are a lot of conversations, but which conversations become part of a discourse? And I take that to mean, in my case, which conversations are conversations that are part of an ongoing dialogue about history, about where we have been structurally, or about not only structurally, but in some kind of larger sense, how people are in the world, not just in the moment, but in the world. So how do we move beyond that? And with StoryCorps, you know, all I know about StoryCorps is their publications and what shows up on the web. I am not familiar with the full interviews. You know, their interviews run, they say, to 40 minutes, et cetera. And from that, they do excerpts. So I'm not familiar with the whole, I don't know what happens afterwards, whether or not in the questioning, whether or not people can put their experiences in a larger context to tell us something about the world in terms of a larger discourse. I think that's the way we kind of honor people by recognizing them as historians, that they are capable of not only telling us stories, but telling us what those stories mean. Mike, first years ago, wrote a very important article, I think, on an experience he had with the New York Times in editing interviews that he and his colleagues at Buffalo had done with the unemployed, and this was in the 70s. And the Times was interested in the emotional side of those stories, but edited out every point where people thought expressed an opinion or interpretation of those events. You know, I'm unemployed, this is what happened to me, and I'm unemployed because, you know, things have moved out of town, the bosses have done this, blah, 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 et cetera, where they put it in context. You know, they would take the story, I'm unemployed, this is what is done for my family, and not the interpretation. And there's a way in which that's what's done in the StoryCorps books on mom or listening as an act of love. They take the pith of the emotional moments and get rid of the interpretation. So the people become, they say they're sharing authority by including the stories, but the people just become objects of emotive attitude. I just read an essay by a guy by Benjamin Feline, who's turned out a volume called Letting Go or something or other, and he opens his own essay there by saying, "Every Friday morning, I get prepared to cry when NPR broadcasts these excerpts from StoryCorps, and they're always moving, and he gets ready to cry." Well, crying's not enough. We have to understand, and you know, the people we interview are perfectly capable of telling us what that means, and it's our job to allow them or to help them do that, if you will. Allow is probably a bad word, but there's a way in which we do control that interview. But in the presentation, it should be there in the presentation as well. But that's my. There's a difference between feeling good and doing history.
When you're interviewing somebody, are there any like tricks or keys that you use to kind of help the interview go well? Any tips maybe for things people should do?
First of all, it's really important to explain exactly what's going to happen, where it's going to go, who's going to look at it, what's going to happen, or what rights that person has. Are they going to get a transcript back? Are they going to get this back? Will they be able to look at it? It's very important that be a totally transparent project. Nothing's hidden. No hidden microphones. No, you know, people can say, stop the recording. It's important they know that they have control of it, exactly what's going to happen. Then within the interview itself, I always think it's important within the first 10 or so minutes to reveal that you know something that they don't know you know, to let them know that you've done your research. Oh, you know about that. Oh, you've talked to somebody about that. Oh, you've read this obscure article, or they say, where did you find that out? So, Harper's Magazine of June 1952. Oh, you know, it's important, I think, at some point in time to let them know that you know. So that they know that you're going to come back at them. It's also important to set the rhythm of the interview. If you begin the interview asking many short questions, people will assume that that's the pace you want. But if you start with questions that require more elaboration, and then ask for more elaboration, as an example I use with Jamil, his interview, where very early on when he said "we," I said, "Who are the we?" And so he knows. Is it by that I want more detail, that I know that there are other people, that he can talk more expansively about it. So that you're setting the pace, you're setting the rhythm. Sometimes that's not enough. I interviewed a congressman one time. He had been a congressman for 24 years, a very important congressman, but he was so used to being interviewed by the press, He knew exactly what the press wanted. And so he would give me an answer, which was a short, now they call them sound bites, but it was something that a journalist could peg the story to. Congressman Sellers said today, blah, 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 and then the story would come. And it was very difficult to convince him that I wanted an answer that was more than two sentences long. And very difficult to get that across. But you want to establish the rhythm. And then I think that most interviews begin to kind of collapse on themselves after about an hour and a half, 2 hours. You know, people get tired. You get tired as an interviewer. You're just not as sharp as you were, et cetera. My objection to people is people talked in this institute about not taking notes a couple of times it was mentioned. And my, why I don't want my students to take notes, why I don't ever take notes, is there some kind of imperative to finish that damn questionnaire. You're coming to the end of the interview, and you've got 40 questions, and you've only asked 30. There's such an imperative to ask every question that you're not listening, that you're thinking about the next question, and who cares? You can come back a second time. But to take it slower, to deal with topics rather than questions, et cetera. You get established the rhythm, you end when you have to end, the little technical problems, technique problems.
So what do you see as your particular contribution your work has made to the field of oral history?
I've talked about a transformation in oral history. I think my work was important in giving people at a moment of time a certain way of looking at an interview rather than the older social scientific way. So, and I think for a moment at least, as I understand the bibliography, people use the term conversational narrative. And I think that was some kind of a contribution, thinking about it in a different kind of way. In terms of the use of oral history and social history, which was from the bottom up, the whole rhetoric of social history, I think my work is really tangential to that, in that my discussion of an interview is something that could be applied to interviews with the work class. And I tried that in one essay in Envelopes of Sound. But I think it was a sensibility that the oral narrative or the oral history is much more than a repository of facts, that it tells us about culture, and that is the same kind of impulse that Luisa Passerini has, that Lutz Niedhammer has, that Sandro Portelli has, et cetera, and that it tells us about the culture. It's a much larger kind of construct. So I think in that sense, there's a kind of correspondence. I think in my professional career, I have tried to move oral history into newer kinds of directions, both in the Oral History Association, in some of my writings, my activities in the public history world. I used to be very active in that world. My work at the New Jersey Historic Commission, my work at Columbia, was to open up oral history to a lot of disparate community activities, working with people who were politically marginalized on their projects, helping redefine those projects, in some cases helping them to secure funding. I think that I brought to projects that would have been considered somewhat marginal, I brought to them a certain kind of respectability because of the work that I had done and the places that I had been. So there's a number of ways in which I think my work has resonated with some positive changes within the profession, I think. Mm-hmm.